Oh, awesome. Hello, everyone, and welcome. Today, we are going to be talking about our cryptocurrency security standard and the key compromise aspect. So I'm Jessica Levesque. I'm C4's executive director, and I'm so lucky to be here today with some of our CCSS committee members. So let's start with intros. Michael, you want to go first?
Sure. My name is Michael Perkland. I'm the chairman of the board of C4, and I serve on the CCSS steering committee. It's a pleasure to be here. Joshua?
Oh, just going to lose my phone at the same time. Joshua McDougall, also a board member of C4, committee member for the CEP and the CCSS. And I've had the pleasure of helping some businesses write their key compromise protocols. Jameson?
Hi, I'm Jameson Lopp, co-founder, CTO of Casa. I have been focused on private key management and self-custody solutions for about 8 years now.
Okay, cool. Thank you all for being here today. So we're going to be talking about key compromise. So this is something that is an aspect in and a control in our standard, the cryptocurrency security standard, but there's also a number of different scenarios that could happen, either if you are an exchange or a custodian, but also even if you just yourself hold your own private keys. So we're going to get into a little bit about what that means. Michael, do you want to start by just explaining what a key compromise is?
Sure. As the name says, a key compromise is a compromise of a key, but it actually goes a little bit further than that. It's any kind of doubt of the confidentiality of a key, as well as any kind of doubt in the trustworthiness of a key operator. Basically, if the key or the operator has had any issues that make you doubt the trustworthiness of that key or that operator, you are dealing with a key compromise.
Anybody want to add to that? I know that the situation or what we're talking about is kind of in the phrase by key compromise, but anything else before we get into the standard?
Sure. I think it's important to note that it's not always malicious things. Sometimes these can be accidents or just, you know, acts of nature. Perhaps there's a flood, which may or may not have destroyed a key that's part of a multi-sig. It's important to know that, you know, no one maliciously flooded the building, but the key compromise protocol may still be something that needs to be enacted.
I'd also say, this covers a whole range of uncertainties, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean that you are sure that a compromise has happened, but rather it's that you are no longer sure that a compromise has not happened.
That's a good way to look at it for sure. So we've got an idea now of what we're talking about with a key being compromised. So why don't we talk a little bit about the standard? So we have a example I'm going to put in our in the YouTube chat where you can find our standard. But if we want to just start by going over what a key compromise policy would be. So in 1.05.1, to reach level one of CCSS, you need to have KCP needs to exist. So does anyone want to go over that a little bit in terms of what's needed for levels one and two?
I'll be happy to. So a key compromise protocol is a set of protocols or a set of steps that you have prepared in advance so that when you do run into some of these trustworthiness issues that we just talked about, you know exactly what you need to do. The last thing that you want to be doing is scrambling about and thinking, okay, well, what should I do? Should I do this? Should I do that? When stress is high and you're fearful of something, it's the worst time to start planning. The best time to start planning is now, when you have a calm, collected demeanor and you can work through all the what if scenarios with your team. So a key compromise protocol is basically this list of steps. When we run into a key compromise, what are we going to do? Step one, do this. Step two, do that. Step three, do the other. And it's difficult to get into any specifics for a specific system because every system is different. But there will be some commonalities for all of the different types of systems that would have a key compromise protocol. Whenever you believe a key is compromised, the goal is to replace that key with a new one. In order to replace that key with a new one, you'll have to create one or more key shares or key pieces, depending on if it's multi-sig or maybe it's just one or more keys, period. You want to test it, send a small amount to it, spend a small amount from it. Make sure that that you do have full control that you believe you do over this brand new key that was just created. You want to create a strong backup, make sure that it's protected against fire, flood, and all the other types of things that the CCSS covers in making that backup. And once you're sure you've created the new key, you've tested it, you've backed it up properly, now it's time to move all the funds from the old key that you believe now may be compromised. You move it all to the brand new one, completing the process. All the steps involved for your specific information system that carry out all of these instructions need to be laid out in the key compromise protocol. This typically would take the form of a document, the KCP document or whatever your organization will call it, and it'll hopefully sit idle and never need to be used. But God forbid you do find yourself in a situation where you suddenly need it. Well, now you can dust it off and just start following the script right from the beginning.
I have a question. How often should something like some company's KCP be updated? So if you've got this policy, is this something that should be regularly updated? And like, what would that look like?
Absolutely. It should be updated regularly. Josh, you want to jump in a little bit more?
I was just going to add that from the standards perspective, there's also, you know, varying levels of preparedness that it expects. A level one actually just requires that there's an inventory of these assets. Everyone kind of knows that these keys, everyone who needs to know knows that these keys exist. And despite, you know, maybe not being a formal document available that outlines all these steps, there's at least one staff member in charge of orchestrating should some sort of incident occur that requires this. And then as we get to level two and level three, that's when the formal document actually starts to be required that, you know, outlines all these steps, outlines a table of contacts and ways of contacting people and the other processes that might occur. The other key word that I just used there was communicate, ways of contacting people. The key compromise protocol could even be a dangerous thing if the way in which it's communicated amongst the team is not done properly. So by simply, you know, sending a SMS text message that a key compromise has occurred and the process should start should not be considered strong enough, and instead strong methods of communication and authentication should be used.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that key compromise policy is kind of like a variation on your key generation framework, because that's what you're essentially having to go through the initialization process that you have done, you know, when you were originally setting up your system, except now you're doing it under a bit more duress because you're afraid that something has gone wrong. So it becomes even more important that you have methodically thought through all the different scenarios and you know exactly what you're doing, because once again, you know, like Josh said, this is a sensitive operation and you don't want to get yourself into a position where you're tricked into initiating a key compromise policy that then has some sort of attacker who has managed to put themselves into a position of trust or a position where they can actually take advantage of you executing this policy.
That's such a good point, especially because, like, I think for most people, if there's something that is happening that's urgent or immediate, it's like there's all these additional things that are going through our minds and makes it easier to make mistakes. So that we might have like this plan set out, but if it isn't really like clear and organized, it would be easier to make a mistake. And I hadn't really thought about that, somebody using that to their advantage too, right? I mean, this is why I'm not a cybersecurity expert like you all are, but that's good to hear and to think of, certainly.
Yeah, in many of the investigations that I've worked on, a false sense of urgency is usually a common attack vector that is used to, you know, confuse and fluster generally the targets or victims of these attacks.
One of the things that the CCSS calls out in this section, in the KCP section, is the use of an authenticated communication channel. Both Jameson and Josh mentioned it, and the importance of this piece can't be understated. It's definitely possible for someone to impersonate a known trusted individual and convince you that they are somebody else. Oh, looks like the key's been compromised. Hey, Josh and Jameson, we need to create brand new keys and replace everything and move all the funds to the new safe keys. And you think that you're working with the real Michael Perklin, the three of us working together to move all the funds. But in reality, I'm an attacker. I'm pretending to be Michael. And I've now just convinced two of the other operators to follow my lead. And it allows you, it allows an attacker to potentially insert themselves as a authorized signer when they were never authorized to begin with. In the CCSS, there's a definition for an ACC, an authenticated communication channel. And that involves what I call in short form as strong auth, getting on a video call where you can see and hear the other person. Maybe even ask them to turn left and say the word banana, turn right and say the word blueberry, just to make it even harder for all these new kinds of deepfakes to pretend that they are someone who they're not. Always the best form of an authenticated communication channel is in person, in the same room. Whether or not that's even possible for your specific system is a totally different story, of course.
Yeah, I like that you brought that up with like saying, you know, having the person that you're meeting virtually with doing something like that and repeating the, like, random words and whatnot. You and I have done that, Michael. And like the random words always make me laugh that you come up with, are random things. And it's like, I mean, and it's important though, it really is. And so if you're always saying the same word or doing the same thing, then that's no longer as secure. So it's like coming up with something that makes sense in that moment. Okay, cool. Anything else that we wanted to say about that specifically before we get into some different scenarios? Okay, so there's a couple of different ways that keys can be compromised. The key itself could be compromised, or there could be something with the key holder. And like we said earlier, there can be different ways that this happens. Sometimes it can be because there is a bad actor. Sometimes it can be just like, you know, confusion. Did this happen? Did this not? Where did I leave this? Things like that. But let's go through a couple examples of what could happen if the key itself was compromised. So Michael and I were talking about some scenarios before the call. And one of them we were talking about is if you've got your private key in a safety deposit box and you go into the safety deposit box, you go to check for it, and you notice that the tamper evidence seal on your bag is open. And you're not sure if you accidentally nicked the bag or if someone was there since you were last in. So either way, what would we do in that scenario? Let's say it's me. I head into the bank, look at the safety deposit box. I find that there's something in there. I'm not quite sure if I left it like that. I'm clumsy, so hard to say. Or if somebody else was in there, what would the next steps be?
next step would be to reach for your key compromise protocol and begin going through one by one. It'll probably say something like, contact the other key holders in your multi-sig arrangement and let them know that you're initiating the key compromise protocol.
Anything else anyone wants to add about that? Is this something that... Oh, go ahead, Michael.
I just wanted to say that in this specific example, it's one of the operators who is initiating the key compromise protocol. It doesn't have to be an operator that initiates the key compromise protocol. Anyone who identifies that there's no longer the same trust in the system as there was before could initiate it. It could be your secretary who has noticed that, according to the video logs, there were many people who went in and out of the room that has the safe overnight. And she calls and says, hey, we can no longer trust that the one key that's here is safe. We need to replace it. As Jameson pointed out, it is less about an amount of trust, and it's more about a lack of trust, or the loss of confidence.
I think it's easy in this type of scenario to think, oh, it was fine. I probably just didn't seal the bag properly. I'll put it in a new bag and this will be fine. It's, 5 days before the holidays. I'm busy. All the other key holders I know are so busy today as well. This is too much effort. It's probably fine. It's probably fine is certainly a nice indication of when you probably want to enact the key compromise protocol, because the reality is that trust is gone. It's probably fine, but it might not be.
Right. And especially, I think that, like, if we're thinking about ourselves, like if I'm like, oh, it's probably fine, but maybe it's just my own money. And like, that's a decision I get to make. But when you're saying it's probably fine and you're custodying somebody else's money and you're making a decision for them, if they would consider it being fine or not, it's like, it's not fine because you are making this decision for somebody else who doesn't have, access to it in the same way you do. And so the right thing to do is exactly what you guys were just saying, was if it's probably fine, then you need to do something about it.
You bring up an interesting point, though. You said, if it was my own money, I can say it's probably fine. And while that's true,
I'm not saying it's a good choice.
If it's your own money, we talk, especially on these CCSS live streams, we talk a lot about what organizations can do and what we hope these organizations do to protect funds of consumers like ourselves as well. But the reality is especially with cryptocurrencies, we need to take responsibility ourselves and kind of lead by example of how we want these businesses. I've had a time when I was in an airport and happened to be traveling with something. And one of the agents took it out of my bag because they thought it was going to be a weapon. It wasn't. But as they're looking at it, they're opening it. They're looking at it this way. They're looking at it that way. Cameras are everywhere. And then they closed it up, said, oh, it's not a weapon, put it in my bag. Now, certainly I can assume, they weren't looking for any sort of cryptocurrency key, but it had been exposed to the cameras, it had been exposed to my fellow travelers, it had been exposed to so many people. I could easily just say, I'm tired and I don't want to worry about this and move along with my life. But the reality is that key was exposed to a hell of a lot more things than I wanted to be exposed to, and I knew it. So even as an individual, the key compromise protocol, I don't have a document and I don't have other people to notify, but it's still, even as an individual, something that we can do ourselves to say, nope, there is a compromise. And now, much to what Jameson was saying, I now know that in the same way I usually generate my keys, I have to do that process, and I have to do it probably with a little bit more speed than usual.
That's a good example, especially because I think we might make the like, yeah, that it's okay or it's not, and you're traveling and there's a lot going on. But so even if it's just, you know, yourself, if you've got a plan in your mind for what would happen if you are traveling and something like that goes down, what do you do? It's not like you necessarily just have like a ledger or treasure, or like another one in your pocket, or like what are the steps that you would take to handle that? Especially like, let's say you're, you know, in an airport and you're changing planes and you're going from one place to the next, there's a lot of different things that you're already dealing with, and then to try to figure that out. Can I ask, Josh, what did you, like, did you have to take care of it right then? Were you like kind of freaking out, or what did that look like?
Luckily for me, it was a key that I happened to use for presentations. So although that there was some on it, it wasn't really anything too concerning for me, but I did deal with it as soon as I got home.
Okay, all right.
We're talking about some examples of when a key might be compromised. A TSA agent takes a look at a piece of steel, or your tamper bag, the seal is for some reason broken when you believe that it should have been intact, and you don't know whether it's something you did or something somebody else did. These are examples of when the key becomes compromised, but the key compromise protocol aspect of the CCSS calls out another set of scenarios, not related to the key, but related to the key holder. It's possible for the key holder to become compromised as well. Some examples of this could be the person has, for whatever reason, become soured against the organization. Maybe they feel like they've been passed over for some kind of a promotion, and now they are vitriolic and are actively speaking against the organization that, you know, they are a key holder to. The other key holders may see that as a form of compromise because they can no longer trust that the key holder will carry out instructions per the policy of the organization, because now they seem to be going out on their own. It's also possible, and this is difficult to contemplate, but if one of the key holders has a child, a son or a daughter, and that child, we've now learned, has been kidnapped, and they're being used as ransom. Either you, organization, transfer me 100 Bitcoin, otherwise this kid is going to, bad things will happen. In that moment, I think it's reasonable for any parent to acknowledge that parent is not going to be thinking clearly. They're not going to be thinking about the organization or the 100 Bitcoin. They're going to be thinking about the safety of their child. That is a prime example of the compromise of an individual. They're no longer thinking about the system. They're thinking about their family. Rightfully so. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, or that they should have a different set of priorities. Absolutely not. Don't mistake my meaning. What I am trying to point out is that the scenario that this individual now finds himself in is a compromising scenario. A prudent organization would very quickly recreate the multi-sig arrangement without that employee involved. So now there is no risk to the organization.
Yeah, I think this is, once again, going back to like the initial key generation, key ceremony, key distribution, you know, it's important to get that right so that a single compromise won't wipe out your organization. You know, take for example, let's say all the executives in your organization are living in the same swanky apartment together. You know, distributing all the keys amongst them is probably not going to be very helpful, because you've opened yourself up to a number of different attacks simply due to their, you know, physical proximity with each other. So, you know, there may be a key compromise that you can't simply execute a policy to get yourself out of a situation.
That's a good point.
That's an excellent point. At no point in the key compromise protocol should you be weakening your system further? There shouldn't be a, okay, we create a temporary wallet instead of the multi-sig, and we send all the funds to the temporary single sig wallet until we can safely create the multi-sig wallet again. We shouldn't be weakening the system during this event. The policy should be designed in a way, or the protocol should be designed in a way in which the strength of the network is not itself compromised in order to, you know, get to someplace, get to the finish line faster.
There's a real example of when a KCP was invoked in Laura Shin's book about Ethereum's early days. Back in 2014, when Ethereum was still in its infancy, it had raised its 30 some thousand Bitcoin in their ICO, and it was stored in a multi-sig arrangement. There were questions about the confidentiality, integrity, or availability of one of the keys, and the KCP was invoked for the Ethereum Foundation at that time. If any of you haven't read Laura Shin's book, you may want to keep an eye out for that little piece of Ethereum history.
Does the book talk about what they did next?
It glosses over, it does not get into any of the technical specifics, no, but it does it does discuss the compromise that was alleged to have taken place. And it was in that moment that a new crypto key system was contemplated to remove the compromise from the system entirely.
Okay. Interesting. What are some, I would be just interested to know some other kind of well-known key compromises that have maybe been shared publicly, and like what the next steps were. Maybe that like a key that was compromised and then nothing actually happened that was negative and it was resolved. Do you guys know of any interesting stories that you're able to share?
Unfortunately, the ones that go okay and properly safeguard user funds, those are the ones you don't hear about. Nobody talks about how everything is humming along as normal. People talk about the actual compromise or the actual loss of funds.
We've got Josh's airport story, which I think is pretty fascinating. But I have heard of people who have said, like, I've made this mistake, and, you know, then I realized that I was doing this and I made a change and whatnot. And then I've also heard of people who have personally just screwed up and lost their money because their key was compromised. But generally, when I've heard that, it's because they lost it. That was the compromise, which is, I can attest to that back, you know, many, many years ago, when I was a little less well-informed and made a mistake.
I can't think of any major like enterprise level key compromise stories off the top of my head, but I can say from my own experience with some Casa clients, we certainly have had clients who have experienced, you know, home break-ins and basically times when, you know, secure locations where they had one of their keys stored had obviously been ransacked. In some cases, the key was actually taken, in others it was not. And, you know, we theorize that it was just a crime of opportunity and the attacker probably didn't even know what the Trezor or Ledger or other hardware device was in the first place. But, you know, in all of those situations, you know, key compromise policy was enacted and they, you know, got a new device, generated a new key, and then, you know, rotated their funds over to the new key set.
Where would somebody store, like, how would an organization or should an organization store this policy? So if you've got it all written out, what does that look like? Like, everybody who has a key has a copy of this. Where does it live? What would this kind of look like in real life?
So, you know, in general, a policy like this should not be particularly sensitive, like in the sense that It should outline a process that includes authentication around all of the sensitive areas, such that, you know, there's no security through obscurity or security through secrecy of the process itself. You know, everyone who is a key holder or possibly an executive in the organization should be able to get their hands on a copy of this and disseminate it as needed. So the policy should, I think, be copied and stored in multiple places where multiple people have access to it. Can't really have too much redundancy for something like this. It's kind of similar to what we see, like when you're setting up a distributed key system in the first place. One of the potential weaknesses is around the sort of public instructions, the public keys, and the other configuration of that key set, such that if you had some sort of disaster and even if a lot of people still had their keys, but you no longer had the instructions for how it was all set up, then you could, lose access to those funds. So, for a public or semi-public, instructional piece of information like this, we generally encourage lots of redundancy because you don't want this to become a potential single point of failure.
Another thing I would caution.
When you're done, I have a follow-up question about this too.
I apologize. Another thing I would caution is stale, outdated, or maliciously altered copies of the KCP. Each key holder should have their own copy, ideally stored on their own computer that they put there themselves and they know they can trust that copy. Maybe also put it on your mobile device, throw it in whatever books app or a place where you can get to it easily on your mobile, you can get to it easily on your computer, because when the KCP is called for, you should be reaching for your copy of the protocol. One of the last things you would want to rely on is in that moment of franticness, you're receiving a copy from someone who purports to be one of the other key holders or someone who purports to be, your executive assistant. Like, oh, Johnny just initiated the KCP. Here's your copy in case you don't have it. Start following steps 1 through 10. Now you're suddenly questioning, can I trust this copy? Is this the same as before? It just removes all those questions when you can reach for your own copy. Lastly, I'd recommend, in addition to having digital copies on your devices that you put there yourself, if it's possible, also have a printed out copy in the location where you're most likely to carry out the KCP. If you have a home office, maybe that's a good place. If you have a boardroom, keep it in the cabinet in the boardroom of your company, if that's the location you are likely to carry out the KCP. As Jameson said, you can't have too many copies.
So my question related to this is, okay, so in the key compromise policy, you know what to do, but as Josh, you were saying, you need to take that next step then. And if you lazily recreate the system, then it's not going to be secure anyways. So where's the distinction between what is in the key compromise policy and how the keys are created and stored so that you can kind of either improve or replicate what you were doing before the compromise? That question makes sense.
Well, yeah. I think that the short version is that I would expect a key compromise policy to be referential, and basically it refers to the same processes that were used during the initialization of your keys and architecture. Like you don't want to be changing the way that you're doing things. More complexity is generally bad. We're already talking about dealing with a fairly complex, organizational, probably multi-key system here. So as simple as you can keep it is better.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, Michael, in a previous live stream, you were talking about how there are 5 different parts of an information system. And policies, procedures, people, what were the other two?
Hardware and software.
Hardware and software. Okay, of course.
Yeah, an information system, but we usually think of an information system as the technology that we're using. And while that's the most tangible piece of an information system, it is only a piece of it. There's the hardware you're using. There's the software running on it. There are the policies your organization may have. There are the procedures that your organization may have that implement those policies. And of course, there are the people who interact with the system. No information system exists without the people that are doing the things with the system, and their training and their adherence to procedure and policy is equally as important as the hardware and software they're using.
Okay, and I was asking about that because I think when we're talking about this, like with the policy, but there also has to be a procedure for what you're doing next and how you're actually implementing that and the people that you trust. So let's say that you have a multi-sig setup and one of the people is compromised because they are missing and maybe not necessarily, like, they turned out to be not that trustworthy. Maybe let's do that scenario, okay? So you've got this procedure in place for what to do and you have an idea of how to set this up again, but you're down one person because things have changed. Do you build into the policy what happens if there's no longer a trusted actor that you originally had in set the system? Like, how would someone go about planning for that within the policy and then actually proceeding to do that?
That's a great question. And there is no hard and fast rule that applies to every system. Again, every individual information system is different, and you'll have to make the best judgment calls that you can for your system. But in a scenario like that, where you are now dealing with the potential compromise of a person rather than the potential compromise of a key, the process is very similar. Instead of only replacing the key, though, you're now also replacing an operator. Maybe there is another person that it makes sense to have that person step in their place. Maybe there is no other person, but it makes sense for the organization to adjust the quorum and the number of key holders. That all depends on how many key holders there were to begin with and whether the system has and the quorum has room to reduce it by one. So you can see here that there is no simple hard and fast rule that applies to everyone, but each of these key holders, they were put in a trusted position because they've shown to that organization that they understand the technical aspects of being a key holder, and they've shown that they are trustworthy enough to be a key holder on behalf of that organization. In my opinion, these people are the prime people to decide whether or not there should be a replacement of one of these people or a reduction in quorum. Now, depending on your organization, maybe there is a policy that says the key holders should never be the ones that choose. Even though I believe that, you know, if you trust someone enough to put them in this place, you should trust them enough to make these types of decisions for the system. Your system may have a rule that these key holders can't make that decision. The board of directors has to make that decision, or some other entity within the organization. Well, now you need to make sure that your key compromise protocol has in amongst its steps contacting that other body, that other organizational body, and getting the permission, clearance, blessing that you need to add that other person into the quorum.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that, you know, you could have a line of succession, as it were, you know, perhaps based on titles or organizational structure. I would probably not want to have, you know, actual people's names in there because those are, you know, bound to change over time, and you prefer to have a policy that is somewhat timeless and doesn't have to be adjusted on the fly. That's kind of the whole point of this, is that you're not hopefully having to make many decisions during a stressful situation. But kind of what I think Michael was getting to is that this can also turn into a governance issue. And it's worth thinking about ahead of time. I personally would suggest avoiding making it a governance issue, and, you know, having the policy itself say ahead of time exactly, you know, how any governance process would happen, so that, you know, once again, you're not making stuff up on the fly.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, you know, self-referential is always helpful as well. So, you know, if there should already be an onboarding process in place that says, you know, this is how, you know, leaving the selection of the person, let's say to however the organization needs to do it. But if there's a new person coming onto the key system, then there should be, you know, maybe those background checks have already taken place on some of these people who are not necessarily key holders yet. They might need new hardware sourced to them, understanding how they're supposed to source hardware, maybe having that hardware sourced before it's necessary might feel a little bit wasteful, but in the time of need, it's certainly better to have some extra hardware while it's sitting around, or extra, even simple as tamper evident bags sitting around with the people who need it. So having those onboarding processes where we bring in our key, our new actor into those key systems, having that established already means that the key compromise protocol doesn't have to say, oh, and then the person goes to the store, and then, you know, we quickly do a background check. Well, those are all already defined within the organization. So anytime we can simplify on that is certainly helpful.
Well, and one of the things in the standard for level three is that in addition to a protocol and having the documentation of this policy written out and disseminated, also there needs to be training and rehearsals for any type of key compromise. So, and I think that really speaks to what we were talking about earlier about if somebody is frazzled with what's going on, having practiced something like this and they know what those next steps are. But so what would that look like? What is like a training and rehearsal for a key compromise? Do you create this based upon all like a variety of different scenarios, or do you have a couple of different training sessions based on if it's like a key that's compromised versus a person, or like, how do you make that so that it's, you know, is it one size fits all? Is it if A happens, do B, or what would that look like? Or maybe I'm making it really complicated because I feel like this goes back to what Jameson said about not making things complicated, but yeah, what would you guys do?
Rehearsals are an essential part of good security. I would recommend that that your organization have different types of instigations that start these types of training. Let's pretend now that Jameson is compromised. Now have everybody walk through the motions, generate a brand new key, do everything up to the point of sending everything to the new key as if we are replacing Jameson. Maybe 6-8 months from that point, let's go through another run through, but we're going to now pretend that it is Michael's key in his safe that he believes may have been accessed. Now let's go through the whole thing again, replacing Michael's key with Michael. Let's replace Josh's key without Josh, and different variants of it. Each time that the key operators go through it, it will be more familiar. It will be easier for them to go through, and it will give them the training, the peace of mind that they need, so that God forbid tomorrow when the KCP is really invoked, they'll know exactly what to do because it's old hat. They've been doing this for a while.
Sometimes incident response can be a lot like a D&D game. And if you want to, you can literally, you know, have some scenarios, roll some dice and say, okay, this is what we're doing today. If you want to really ensure that no one is, you know, just kind of going through the motions and they're forced to actually think about, okay, what is this? It's a different scenario than I'm used to and what I expected, but let's go through it.
So someone put a comment in the chat, and I'm not sure if anyone has a response to this or not. The person said, I'm really rarely concerned about our KCP because my CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer, but Skynet presets the switch to read only when we're set out alone. I have no idea. Is that a joke? Is that what is that?
I have a response. I think, thankfully, by the time Skynet is turned on in, I believe it's 2032, The Terminators will be our best friends by that point, so it's not an issue.
Sounds like I need to do some research. Some learning to do myself. Okay, so let's see here. What else do we want to talk about with key compromise? We've talked a little bit about the trainings and whatnot, but I guess there's one other thing I wanted to bring up. I think, Michael, you're the one that brought this up, but this idea of, or maybe it was you, Jameson, but the idea of making sure that you don't have extra copies around or like old copies of this. So like, should the policy include a policy for old policies?
Good record keeping has version numbers in documents. I'd recommend using a version number that is clear and unambiguous, such as a date rather than a simple number that gets incremented. So if you're using the key compromise protocol as written from June 2017 and it's 2022, you as a key holder, you should know whether that KCP has been updated since 2017. If you know that you just updated a few months ago and now you're looking at a document that says 2017, this is the old one. Let me find that new one.
Okay, for all the other people out there who missed the joke earlier, I feel like we have to point this out that it was a Terminator joke. I just Googled it and was like, oh my God.
Sorry, anyways. Sarah Connor wouldn't get it either.
Actually, Terminator is the first movie that I cried in because I was scared because I was a kid and we had my dad had to take me out and my brother was pissed that we had to leave the theater. So I'm actually going to see him tonight. I'm going to have to bring this up.
So that's why you didn't get the reference. You probably blocked out that trauma.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure. No, I've seen it since. I'm with you all now. Okay. So is there anything else that we should be sharing about key compromise, what people should be aware of when either they themselves have a key compromise or how we should go about this for organizations, companies that are maybe looking to become CCSS certified? Anything that we haven't covered that you all feel like is important to address?
I think just the general spirit behind it. If you're building your own security for your own self, chances are you're not going to be dealing with multi-sig. You're just having your own key. Having an awareness of how everything is done and the processes that you went through is good enough. And you can create a CCSS compliant system for your own keys in your own home, all on your own. If you're acting on behalf of an organization, however, a lot more planning would need to be done, not only because there are more keys involved in the crypto system, but more formal documentation, more formal policies, more formal procedures, more formal versioning requirements on your documents and tests and iterations and war games. This is when and how you can reach level two or level three, depending on your level of preparedness. The last thing I'll say is having access to good tools can dramatically simplify your job, not only in the CCSS, but with things like the key compromise policy. The CCSS has qualified service providers, QSPs. These are companies that go out of their way to cover as many of these controls that the CCSS has so that you don't have to. And all you need to worry about are the few that they can't cover for you, like where are you backing up your key and how are you backing up your key. QSPs can't do that for you. You need to do it for yourself. I know that all the early work that what was CCSS compliant that the Ethereum Foundation went through when it was building its cold storage ICO system, all that work has been open source. So if you search for key compromise protocol, you can likely find a few different documents from a few different organizations that have open sourced their work. Read through these, understand what they did, and draw on their knowledge when you're designing and building your system and when you are drafting your own key compromise protocol. You don't have to do it all on your own. There's plenty of resources available for you to draw from. And it never hurts to reach out to any of us here on this call, whether it be C4 directly through Jessica or through any of the other guests that we have on this live stream, Joshua, Jameson, or myself. Chances are we can answer your question easily or point you in a direction to give you the answer you seek.
I'd also say, you know, what we're really talking about here is a situation in which you have architected a reasonably secure system, and now you have reason to believe that there has been some sort of degradation in the integrity of that system. You know, if you've built a system that is just a single key that you're protecting, and you believe that that key has been compromised, you know, most likely if it has actually been compromised by a malicious attacker, the money's already gone. So this is in a situation where the money's still there. You're just no longer completely sure about the integrity of the system. So it's important to be methodical and you know, to go through a process. And the reason we're doing this is because we want to reduce the potential for mistakes or the potential for other attackers to actually be taking advantage of the process. So, you know, this is a part, of course, of a much larger system of rules and protocols that encompass the standard. And the whole point of the standard is to build a robust information system that can tolerate compromises of some sorts. So that's why we're here. You know, we've helped people architect a system that is quite robust against a wide variety of different attacks and losses. And we understand that, you know, things happen, but if you've architected the system well, then one thing going wrong isn't catastrophic. But when something goes wrong, you need to be able to address it and basically get the integrity of the system back to full strength.
I think those are good points. We've got this standard that's free. It's open, right? You don't have to pay to look at it. You don't have to pay anything. You can look at the whole thing, design your system around this. And if you've got questions and they're not answered in it, you can always reach out to us. Also, for those systems that are going through and being audited, they're getting feedback from their auditor on what they're doing or what they're not doing, what changes they would need to make in order to up their security as well. And there are also organizations out there and auditors that are doing gap assessments to say, here's what you're doing, here's what you should be doing in order to be level one or level two or level three. And so those resources exist, and we're hoping that you will continue using them. I know, Michael, you and I talked recently about how hundreds of systems have already been looking at this looking at the standard to design it. And these are the systems that are doing so in a more safe way. So if you are either holding your own keys or others, use it. It exists for a reason. And the reason everyone's on this call is just because we want the space to be safer and for people to not be losing their money or other people's money. All right, well, anything else we wanted to add before we close? No? All right, well, the standard is linked in the notes, so please read up on it, reach out for questions. We'll be back next year. Oh, God. We'll be back next year for more live streams. That's very weird. I did not realize that, but okay. Have a wonderful rest of the year, and we'll see you in 2023.
Stay safe out there, everyone.
All right, thank you.
Happy holidays.